Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Shattered Lives. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, and we here at Shattered Lives are so excited to welcome you to this unique show, taking you beyond the details of the crime and the perpetrator and getting to the heart of what crime victim families experience and what they need in the aftermath of the crime. And prior to each show, please go to www.donnagore.com or imaginepublicity.com to read the background of the case or the organization featured the week before our show is aired. And please don't forget, in case you can't listen live every week from 5 to 6 Eastern Time, you can always listen at any time, anywhere, given our archival feature within 24 hours or so by going to the Inside Lens group of radio shows on Blog Talk Radio. And our graphic is the big red heart with the cracks. And then we do a detailed blog and podcast after that. So with that said, I say welcome again, everyone. It's a pleasure to have you. It's so rewarding to speak to my national audience every week. I feel so honored to have this forum to give people a national voice on so many intriguing topics. And today is no different because we have a stellar guest, a very knowledgeable and interesting man whom I met this past June, who I will bring in just a few minutes. And we're going to be talking about forensic science, and I'm sure it'll be very intriguing and educational for everyone. But before I do, I want to make a couple of announcements and a couple of thank yous. Tonight I have the able assistance of Kim Colton from Milwaukee, who's substituting for Delilah Jones. Thank you so much, Kim, for doing the switchboard and
well,
welcome with
you,
us.
Thank you, Donna. Well, thank you, and it's nice to be here.
Well, thank you. It's always a pleasure to have you. And I want to say that my understanding is Delilah is still tied up in her responsibilities with caretaking Susan Murphy Milano, who is at the threshold of the end of her life, sadly, with stage 4 multi-organ cancer. But she would want us to continue our good works with all of the many projects we do for crime victims. And that's what we are doing. I want to remind everyone that regardless of how long she may have, we're still looking for monetary donations. Her autobiography that came out, Holding My Hand Through Hell, a stellar book through Ice Cube Press, is donating 10% of their funds. So please go to icecubepress.com. Her wonderful tool that has saved thousands of women's lives, the Evidentiary Abuse Affidavit with the Apple app, is available. So please go to her website and pass that on, and as well as monetary donations will be accepted at the Surfside Beach P.O. Box 14946. So with that said, thank you, everyone, and we are dedicating this show actually to Delilah and to Susan tonight. Our hearts and our prayers are with them. We have a very interesting guest, as I said. His name is Peter Valentin. He is a man who wears many hats these days. I met him in the context of visiting the Henry Lee Institute in West Haven, Connecticut. He has had previously a distinguished career with the Connecticut State Police until he retired in August of 2011, where he investigated homicides and suspicious guests and other major crimes. He is also a master's level instructor in forensic science at the University of New Haven. And he's pursuing his PhD at City College of New York. He graduated from John Jay College of Criminal Justice, a very renowned school. And my understanding, he's also a consultant for hurricanes, like the hurricane that's coming up the East Coast here. He's consulted in those regards, as well as being an expert in blood spatter interpretation, bombing, explosive type of apparatus, alternate light sources, and many, many other types of things. So, Pete, I say thank you so much, and welcome to Shattered Life. We're thrilled to have you this evening.
Well, thank you, Donna. It's a pleasure to be here, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk to your listeners and share some of my experiences with them. And can I say I wish Susan all the best and hope that she can continue and be as comfortable as possible.
Well, thank you. We do appreciate that, and we're just doing everything we can, and we hope that her passage is a peaceful one, and we all are going to continue her works and her legacy. So we do thank you for that. You know, I just thought, being the practical person that I am, since you have a lot of experience in dealing with disasters, weather among them, since those of us who are on the East Coast, I happen to be in Connecticut, and you, as you know, you are on alert, as they say, in terms of being at the ready for this hurricane. We don't know how serious it's going to be, but could you spend just a minute or two with regard to tips, maybe those people that are affected by this? It would be helpful, and then we'll get into the heart of the matter, why we're here.
I'd be more than happy to, and yes, you're right. As a matter of fact, just this afternoon, I received word that I'm now on alert for the team that I belong to, and frankly, you know, we hope we never get deployed, because what I do for the National Disaster Medical System is that I am responsible for assisting in mass casualty incidents. So hopefully I'm not used, because if I'm used, that means we have a lot of fatalities. And so you know, you can imagine something like Hurricane Katrina, where we had, you know, well in excess of 2,000 casualties, 2,000 deaths. You know, there's a tremendous need. It's a forensic capability, if you can imagine that, to make sure that you positively identify the victims of the storm so that they can be returned to their families. And so we hope that we never get utilized, and maybe going on alert is all that I ever do. But with that in mind, certainly there's some common sense things that perhaps I can share with your listeners so that they're prepared for the storm. And truly, I think we all hope that this is much ado about nothing. But it doesn't seem like that's going to be the case this time around. And no matter where the storm makes landfall, it's going to impact a significant portion of the population. And I hope everybody is preparing as if they were the ones that were going to be impacted most severely by the storm. And so anticipate losing power for a significant period of time. And what's significant? I would say certainly at least several days. And so think about how you're going to feed yourself if you can't cook using whatever you might have in your house. What's going to happen to the things in your refrigerator? How are you going to feed your family? Do you have other appliances that rely upon electricity? Are you going to be able to access running water without having electricity? And if you begin to think about those things, you begin to prepare accordingly. Certainly, you're going to want to have lots of batteries for your flashlights. And so if you don't have flashlights, you should get some. You should have a way of listening to the radio, so you either want a battery-powered or a crank radio so that you can hear to any weather announcements that might come out. If, and I'm certainly one of them, if you have a cordless phone at home, that's not going to work if the power goes out. And so if you have the ability to get an old-fashioned phone that plugs into the wall, that might still work, even if the electricity goes out. So that might be something you'd want to get if you can.
Or your typical landline, Pete, will that work? Because the cables are underground, is that right?
On plenty of occasions, the actual telephones will work, even if the electricity is down, because they don't always share the same transmission system. Right? They're not all on the same poles.
Right.
So you might lose power, but you might still have phone service.
Okay. Well, I think those are some common sense things, and hopefully, I mean, a lot of our people that I work with are based in the Carolinas, Myrtle Beach area is where Delilah is right now. I'm in Connecticut. You are there, and it's traveling up, and my understanding is it's going to hit more full force in our area, maybe Monday evening. So everyone, please do keep those tips in mind, and I thank you so much for that. And there's certainly a lot of resources at the state of Connecticut. Happen to be an employee of that, and there's a multitude of resources there as well with the state emergency management. So now that we've done our little commercial, Pete, why don't we talk about the topics at hand? When I chatted with you earlier this week, I mean, there's so many things we could talk about, but I think you had recently put together or had done a presentation with respect to a particular area of forensic science that really not a lot of people have honed in on in terms of the backlog of crime scene evidence and how labs are doing processing or not doing that and how we deal with that whole issue. So first of all, I wanted to ask you, and this may be a common question, but can you kind of explain the myths that are perpetuated on TV and the media by what they think goes on in a lab in terms of processing evidence by portrayals of TV shows versus what actually happens?
Sure, and I'm sure many of your listeners have watched whether it's an episode of CSI or NCIS or I mean the number of shows is actually beyond my ability to remember, but a lot of shows have depicted criminal investigation and specifically forensic science, and they do a good job of making what I do or what I did seem much more interesting than it actually is, or perhaps they make it look like it progresses much faster than it actually does. And the reality is that what we do is a very time-intensive process. It requires a tremendous amount of patience because investigating a crime scene is not something that you can do within an hour or 2 hours, or certainly within the span of a television episode.
Mm-hmm.
It requires a considerable amount of attention. And so I think one of the myths that gets perpetuated is that there's always this very easy path for us to follow, that once we get to the crime scene, we soon discover who it is that we're looking for, or we immediately recognize what evidence is important for us to examine, and that there's this seamless transition from the crime scene to the forensic laboratory. There's absolutely no backlog. We just essentially sit right down and look at the
evidence.
You
just walk in the door with a bag of evidence and they say, okay, we'll do it right now.
Right. And on a side note, the labs on TV are dimly lit with all these very interesting colors of light that don't exist in a real forensic laboratory. And then things progress in an incredibly logical fashion to the inevitable suspect, who incidentally confesses within about 1 minute of being interviewed, which also doesn't happen. So the reality of the situation is that it's often much more confusing in real life, and it takes a much longer time to not only investigate a crime scene, but to get useful information from it.
Well, I think that's an important distinction that people really need to hear because, it is not tied up, in a neat little package, as you say. And I learned so much when I sat in on your class that I think that's very, like I say, it's a very important thing. What are the true realities of the situation that you're dealing with in terms of how different variables impact your ability to submit evidence, the actual backlogs, the politics involved, et cetera? What are the realities versus the myths?
Well, I think two realities jump to my mind, and they find themselves sort of in almost all of our cases. And I think that what I'd share with you all is that, well, not all cases are solved with forensic science. And in fact, the statistics, depending on which group of researchers you follow, the number is actually in the 30s or 40s in terms of percentages. And so
okay.
a lot of cases are still solved by what seems to be old-fashioned detective work, knocking on doors, talking to people, deconstructing alibis, and just following the trail, as it were. The other thing that I think surprises people is that even if we have evidence that we want to examine forensically, we can't wait for the results of those examinations for our investigation to continue. So we do our work almost regardless of what the forensics is going to tell us, because it just wouldn't make sense for us to sit and wait to see what the evidence had to say.
Is there a rule of thumb in terms of the timeline, realistic timeline, when if you submit one thing, whatever it may be, how long does it take to process it? Because of the backlog, are you really talking like a year or more or something like that?
Well, that's a great question, and to properly answer it, I'd almost have to know which lab you're talking about specifically and
okay.
what kind of crime it was. Now,
right.
it's fair to say that just about any lab operates with some backlog. And when I mean backlog, I mean something actually beyond the amount of time it actually takes to conduct the test. So DNA you don't get results from DNA in 5 minutes. It takes a good day in order for you to run through the entire process. And so even if there was no backlog and I had an analyst essentially waiting for me at the door, I wouldn't have the results in less than a day. But because some sections of the lab are utilized more than others, there's a different backlog depending on what it is that you want examined. And so in some situations, the backlog is so pronounced that you are talking in excess of a year. You are talking, in some situations, the lab might not even accept your evidence because it's not a serious enough crime, and their resources are always focused on major crimes. And so you might never rise to the top of the list, if you will.
Okay, so there is a hierarchy then of the seriousness of the crime. It goes, to the top of the list in terms of who, what may be processed, and something that is considered, lesser, will go to the bottom of the list. Is that right?
Absolutely. And now, this only exists because we don't have enough resources to have as many analysts as we would want at the lab. In an ideal world, the forensic laboratory wouldn't have any, financial constraints, and they would be able to hire enough analysts to, immediately examine every piece of evidence that came in. Unfortunately, we don't operate under ideal circumstances, and so we do have, depending on the lab and depending on what type of evidence you have, we do have some backlogs, and the way that the cases are organized in terms of priorities, certainly one of the criteria is the seriousness of the offense. And so if somebody has their car broken into and their iPhone is taken from the center console, that case is not going to be given the same priority as an attempted homicide. And I think that's entirely appropriate.
Sure. That is, I wouldn't expect. Kim, did you have a question relevant to this area, I think?
Well, I was wondering, what can we realistically do regarding the backlog of processing evidence in labs?
So, Kim, that's a great question. Thank you for asking, because as I was talking to Donna earlier in the week, I mentioned to her that I was at a conference about a month ago, and I presented a presentation on this very issue. I think the problem with backlogs is only going to increase because as we become more and more aware of the ability of forensic science to help in a criminal investigation, it only makes sense that the amount of evidence that we're going to receive is going to increase. And I think we'll never really keep pace with the increase in the amount of evidence coming in terms of having analysts ready to look at that evidence for us.
Right.
So I was advocating that we need to look at this problem in a slightly different fashion, and we need to think about what other ways we can manage this, you know, burgeoning workload, because it's not going to change. It's certainly not going to slow down, and I don't think it will ever decrease.
So given that we have limited resources and not enough analysts, then what would you, can you expound a little bit more on the strategies that you think may work if our economy doesn't improve, if we don't get enough analysts, et cetera?
Sure. And let me preface this all by saying that if it was up to me, we would have as many analysts as we needed in order to analyze everything as soon as it came in. I think that would be the ideal. But I'm also enough of a realist to know that that probably will never happen.
Great.
So one of the things that we can do is to try to manage the amount of evidence coming into the lab. And a lot of times evidence is collected with the anticipation that it might be relevant to our case, but we don't always know. And so there's this, you know, reflexive, we almost immediately think that, well, we've seized 50 pieces of evidence. Let me send all 50 to the lab to get looked at because I don't know which one's going to be important just yet.
Mm-hmm.
And if resources weren't an issue, I would say that that would be a good thing to do, but we know that resources are precious. And so if we apply a bit of logic to the evidence that we have and begin to think about what range of possibilities we have, what could have happened at our crime scene, which is the most likely scenario, some of those pieces of evidence emerge as being more important than others.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's that smaller subset of evidence, it's not all 50, maybe it's 6 or 7 or 8 pieces out of that 50. And
so it's like a process of elimination?
Yes, that's a good way to think about it, right? Not all possibilities have the same likelihood.
Okay.
And so if you begin to think about what's the most likely scenario and choose your evidence for submission based on that, you're not submitting as much. And certainly always pay attention to where your investigation is going so that if your idea of what happened changes, re-examine what evidence you've had submitted and either submit more or change what it is that you're asking to be done with the evidence you've already submitted.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You know, on a real fundamental level, I'm advocating that we be smarter about what it is that we have done.
Hmm. What else do we need to do?
Well, one of the other things that we need to do is, I said it to you earlier this week, the term I said collaborate. And what I meant by that was that, you know, I do police training now, and I went to a lot of training when I was a detective. And so the better trained we are, the more knowledgeable we are about what evidence can do for us in an investigation. And so we become a bit more savvy when we're at a crime scene. And so we can sort of pick through, you know, the almost limitless number of things that are at a scene for us to seize. And we begin to hone in on those really, you know, the handful of things that really can push our case in the right direction. So we become smarter about what evidence we seize. And so part of that is also recognizing where your limitations are. As well-trained as I was, there were people who were much better trained and much more experienced in certain areas. And so the collaboration piece of it really goes to me knowing who my experts are, who's better than me at these particular areas, and how do I get them involved in my case early on so that I choose the best pieces of evidence, and then I ask for the most appropriate testing. So, in essence, make phone calls, get people from the forensic lab to come to your crime scene, get other detectives who have specialized training to come to your scene, and so you develop this team approach.
Right.
So that it, you know, your success at a scene is not dependent on any one person's training and experience.
I'm going to play devil's advocate here for a second. Can people in law enforcement put their egos aside to be able to do that and say, you know what, I don't do this quite as well as Joe Blow over here, so I'm going to call him?
You've hit upon an important concept that I brought up at this discussion as well. And
yeah.
I don't think the ego component to all of this is limited to law enforcement. I think we all have that tendency to take some ownership of our work and not want to relinquish that responsibility. And that is exactly what I'm advocating. But what I'm trying to do is, when I talk about this, I want people to refocus on the team doing a better job, and not necessarily me as an individual doing a better job.
Right.
Because if I make a mistake and our case doesn't get solved because of it, I'm not the only person who doesn't look professional. It's everybody I work with.
Mm-hmm.
It's my unit, it's my department that bears the responsibility for that failure to solve the case. And so with that in mind, nobody's going to remember Pete Ballantyne dropping the ball. They're going to remember the entire squad that I worked with.
Yep.
And so when you think about that, it hopefully reminds people that it's not about your ego. And I tell people all the time is that you need to put your ego in the trunk of your car when you go into a crime scene, because it's not about you. I would personally rather be wrong so that my entire unit gets it right.
I agree with you, yeah. There's, you know, people's lives are at stake. So, you know, you have to be that. And so is all of that under the collaborative piece? Or it sounds like you were also talking a bit about advocating, because you're advocating for the team process and to do the best possible work, you know, among all of the experts that you do have.
Well, yes, I think advocating is also a critical piece of this. And the reason I mentioned that as well, and you brought it up also, is that a lot of times as an investigation progresses, the investigation begins perhaps with the police being involved, but the case isn't over at that point. Let's say we've identified a suspect, we're going to need to get an arrest warrant or a search warrant, and then when the case goes to a prosecutor, a lot of times there's additional suggestions that they might have, or they'd like us to run down additional leads before they sign off on whatever it is that we're presenting. Or they anticipate that there's a line of attack that the defense might use to diminish the importance of what it is that we've done, or to raise doubt as to whether or not we've identified the right person. And quite often, those things that they identify generally don't have a lot of bearing, or they don't have a lot of relevance as far as what we would need to do in a case. And
right.
we many times we end up doing what's asked of us just so that we can finish the case. And that ends up using a lot of resources to conduct all of this additional forensic testing so that we can prevent a defense argument that hasn't even occurred yet.
Yeah, to me it sounds like the political's getting in the way of the scientific.
Sometimes that is what it turns out to be. And when we recognize that the prosecutors or the attorneys in general, the attorneys and the judge, they are not the forensic experts. And so rather than conducting tests of some sort that really have no bearing on the case, I say we should advocate and we should explain to those asking for the tests why those aren't necessary, why they're not probative, why they're not relevant, and if needed, testify about that fact at the trial,
right,
as opposed to conducting a needless test in order to shut down an argument that might or might not be made. Because in order for the defense to make the argument, they might have to present their own expert testimony.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we should shift the burden back where it belongs and not almost reflexively perform tests to try to make our case appear stronger. I'd rather have somebody testify about the strength of the case as it currently is than have some needless tests add on to that burden.
Right, and in doing so, then you are encompassing that third element of education, right?
Yes, and if you think about it, if we were to have a subject matter expert come into trial and testify about why the point the defense is trying to make doesn't hold water because there is no forensic value in it, we've educated the jury. And so that education component really extends to everybody in the criminal justice system and goes well beyond the police.
Yeah, well, it seems to make a lot of sense. I would hope that you would, well, did you, in coming up with this, did you tell people how these things would be accomplished utilizing these strategies? I mean, given the situation as it is?
I don't pretend to be smart enough to know how to actually achieve this across the country. In fact, these are only, maybe these are my musings or my grousings about what
so
my experiences were.
It's theoretical right now. It's theoretical.
Well, I think the answer is different for, I'd say, every jurisdiction, every region.
Right.
You know, we all start in different places as far as our relationship with the forensic laboratory, our relationship with the prosecutors that ultimately review our cases. And so for some places, this might already exist in some form or another, and the only thing we would need to do is accelerate the process so that we can achieve some real benefits. In other places, you know, we might have almost no relationship with the other players, right, with the forensic laboratory, with our prosecutors, and so we might actually need to start building those relationships before we can do any of this.
Right.
And so what I really mean to do is essentially suggest an approach to dealing with the backlog that doesn't include simply hiring more analysts, because we're always essentially going to be behind the power curve if that's how we're approaching it.
So you are planting the seed, which is very important for any ideas to grow.
I'd like to think that I did, and I was gratified that after my talk, I had a few people come up to me and say, we're already doing something like that, but it's good to see that somebody's advocating it on a nationwide basis.
Wow,
and
that's
so
wonderful.
It is, and you know, much of this is personality-driven. You need one person who sees the bigger picture and in a position where they can affect some change, and you'd be amazed at what can happen. And it's great to see that in some parts of the country, this is how they're approaching this very real problem. And what I think bears, you know, tremendous, you know, it's something that your audience would really understand, is that if you think about the backlog in this way, you'll see why it's so important. Imagine, for instance, we had a burglary, which in the grand scheme is not a high priority crime. And in the investigation of that crime, a biological fluid was swabbed. And we hope to get DNA from that biological fluid. It's around the point of entry, so we know it's probably important. And because it's not a high priority crime, it doesn't get analyzed, and we don't develop a profile for, let's say, 1 year. And in that year, the person whose profile that is commits another serious offense.
Okay.
And we would have caught that person if we had analyzed that unknown profile sooner. So if we had understood whose DNA profile it was, we would have been able to arrest them, and they wouldn't have been free to commit the crime that they ultimately committed. And so we have a new victim now that we wouldn't have, it didn't need to happen.
Right.
But it's
hindsight is 20/20. Yeah. Oh,
Right. It happens
that
because
happens
of
all
the backlog.
Time, right? It happens all the time.
I shudder mm-hmm. to think, but I'm sure it does.
Yeah,
I'm
and
sure
I
it
mean,
does.
It probably sat, I mean, although it was packaged appropriately, I'm sure, because I learned some about that in your class, it sat on a shelf somewhere, right? For a year?
Right, right. Because it wasn't as important as the homicides that come up or the, you know, the serious assaults. I mean, it's not to say that what we did focus on wasn't important. It absolutely is. Right? These are more serious offenses. But when
right.
you think about it in that personal way, that because we couldn't get to this evidence sooner, somebody else became a victim. I think when you make it that individual,
that person.
You realize that this is a big deal.
It is, yeah. Kim, did you want to make a comment?
Yeah. Well, so I agree that I'm sure that kind of thing goes on all the time. A question I have, though, when we're talking about the crime victims, Peter, is what important points do crime victims really need to know regarding the DNA analysis or crime or the victim's family?
Well, I think they should be advocates for the increased funding so that there isn't this much of a backlog. From what I've seen, crime victims have a bully pulpit that nobody else has. And when you tell mm-hmm. the story in those personal terms and you realize right. the tragedy that's been visited on a particular family, that speaks in a way that a, you know, that somebody involved in the police department with a budget, just, we can't do that.
Right.
We don't make, our case is not nearly as compelling. We talk about numbers, we talk about budgets, we talk about salaries, and that just isn't as real as having a victim say, this might not have happened to me.
But where is the funding coming from?
The funding for a forensic laboratory and for the personnel necessary to do it, obviously it comes from the jurisdiction that actually has the laboratory, but that's not the complete answer to the question. Laboratories have access to federal funds through grants for research and for particular types of testing. And so a lab has a number of avenues that they can go down in order to get funding for positions. And part of it really goes to the you know, how inventive and how creative the laboratory wants to be in terms of getting funding. You know, an agency that has a good grant writer can get a tremendous amount of money for equipment and personnel and essentially new capabilities that other labs might not have. And so part of what we need to do is essentially pick our heads up and look at down the road and see where we're going and see how we get the funding to get to where we want to be.
Mm-hmm. Can you speak to what's going on at the Henry Lee Institute with regard to those kind of grants and everything? I know Tim spoke about it a little bit when I was there in the summer, but what's the situation there? Are they in fairly good shape with regard to getting grants or what? Endowments?
Well, I'm very privileged to work with a phenomenal faculty in the forensic science department, and they are all undergoing or embarking on some great research that's going to push forensics in new directions. And so a lot of it is you know, through federal funding. We apply for grants mm-hmm. in order to, you know, make our research come alive. You know, it's a good idea until we get some money to really try it out.
Right.
And so we're making progress, but you know, we're only one institution. And so
mm-hmm.
this needs to happen across the country. There are a lot of people who are essentially out of the academic world who are actually doing the job in a forensic laboratory, and they can get funding as well. And so, it comes down to the laboratory recognizing what an important revenue stream funding, that kind of funding can be,
mm-hmm.
and you just need to try to get it.
So they need to have at least one person dedicated in there to, that's all they do, so that you can have the dollars coming in.
Somebody with an ability to really explain how what the laboratory does impacts public safety, how the addition of an analyst or two would incredibly, you know, would reduce the backlog. I mean, you almost have to have an eye on what the NIJ is doing, the National NIJ, which is where most of the funding comes from, what it is that they're interested in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well,
yeah.
It's going to take persistence. And I think it is there, even though the federal government, they say, are, you know, downsizing a lot of their programmings, it has to be there. There's so much waste in government, even in the state level. But, you know, you need to have those people and continue to persevere, I guess. Pete, practically speaking, if you were to kind of bring it back to the crime victim and family members, et cetera, if you or your family member or friend were involved with regard to a new crime that has happened and you come upon the crime scene, we all know from, you know, just watching a lot of TV or hearing that you are not supposed to go into enter the crime scene. But what else is there that we need to know if a person is encountering this kind of situation, other than, you know, don't enter the premises? And then I wanted to see if you might be able to talk a little bit about, you explained the importance of packaging with paper versus plastic and cross contamination.
Well, I think one of the things that you can do, clearly, now I'll put my detective hat on for a moment and say that I wouldn't want you entering something that you recognize as a crime scene. But, it, you know, if somebody is injured and needs medical attention, I mean, that supersedes any investigative function, right? We certainly wouldn't think that's not acceptable. You go and you try to render aid and save somebody's life if you could. But,
right.
But let's say that the person encountered something where that wasn't an issue and you saw it was a crime scene. Yeah, I'd want you to close the door and essentially wait outside for the police to come. But there's one other very important thing that you can do. You might be the only person who sees something that might not exist by the time first responding officer arrives, or even when I arrive later as a detective, because generally I'm not the first one to show up. And so these observations about these conditions that will change over time might make the difference between a case getting solved or not. So, and we call them transient conditions, or we call it conditional evidence. You know, these are things, whether it's evidence itself or whether it's a particular observation about a scene, that is not going to be there later, or it's going to change as a function of time. And so
Can you give us some examples?
Absolutely. Imagine for a moment you arrived at a crime scene. When you opened up the door, you saw that there was a cup of ice cream on a countertop.
Yeah.
And it was still solid, and it had a spoon sitting in it, and it was on the countertop. You said, oh, my goodness, there's a crime here, and you closed the door and you called the police. And so in the 5 or 10 minutes it might take a police officer to show up, when he opens up that door, that ice cream is no longer solid. It's just a soupy mess. But the fact that it was solid when you saw it 5 minutes ago actually tells me something about when the crime might or might not have occurred.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of observation could be very important. You know, it's about essentially the temperature in the room, and it's about the temperature of the ice cream. And so those two pieces of information give me an idea about when the crime might have occurred.
And you might say the same with the footprints in the snow kind of thing too, right?
Footprints in the snow, vehicles that might be driving away at a high rate of speed, things that seem out, and I'll just say the term out of the ordinary, whatever that means. But somebody who's familiar with an environment knows what's supposed to be there and what's not supposed to be there. And so, you know, when we're under extreme stress, we have this tendency to not notice a lot of things. You know,
right.
We get tunnel vision. And so if you can, you know, take a few deep breaths and try to fight off that tunnel vision and be observant about what is going on around you, one of the things that you observe might make the difference in a case being solved or not.
If you can sufficiently calm yourself down and not feel so freaked out about what you've just seen, correct?
Correct. And I know what I'm saying isn't easy.
Right.
But perhaps when you think about it in that larger context, that your ability to observe something that we can't because we're not there yet might be what makes the case.
Well, I think that's good for us to keep in the back of our mind because you never know. And yeah, I think we always have to be good observers and be vigilant about, you know, our environment anyway, just, you know, to kind of protect ourselves and be aware. So I think that's very good advice. But, you know, you spent quite a long time in your class talking about the very detailed aspects of, you know, packaging things and how not to cross-contaminate things and whatnot. Can you give us, we have about 13 and a half minutes left of our show, just to let you know. I'm watching the clock here. And just can you give us a little primer on, you know, why it's so important that things be packaged in paper versus plastic and why, you know, you need to be cognizant of not contaminating things and what happens if that does happen?
Sure. And I'd love to be able to say that, well, we do it because we're environmentally friendly, but actually the real reason goes beyond our concern about our carbon footprint.
Yeah.
You know, I finding useful evidence is hard all by itself. It's a difficult task. Being able to distinguish what's relevant from what's irrelevant is a skill that is hard to learn, and it takes a lot of practice, if you will. You need to go to a lot of different crime scenes in order to get that skill working.
Right.
And I think the tragic piece of all of this is that if we are learning how to recognize what's useful evidence or not, and we collect it, we photograph it, and we do everything that we need to do, and we package it the wrong way so that when it comes to the lab, it can't be looked at, that's a huge failure on our part, and we should do everything we can to prevent that from happening. So while we pride ourselves on being good crime scene investigators, we also need to have an eye towards packaging things so that they survive to be looked at again later.
Okay.
So, Donna, you picked up on the idea that it's paper versus plastic. And the reason why we do that for most kinds of evidence is because we don't want moisture to build up in the items that we collect. Because moisture is going to, if we have moisture in a plastic container, right, and plastic generally is non-porous,
right,
so that moisture can't escape the container. And so that moisture is going to, allow for bacteria to grow, and bacteria certainly are going to consume the cells that might contain DNA, but generally speaking, they're going to most likely destroy the evidentiary value of what it is that we collected. And so we choose paper because it's porous and we don't have to worry about moisture so much. Now, before we put evidence in paper, we need to make sure that it's dry. So if we collect an item of evidence that has some moisture on it, we're going to need to put it somewhere until it dries sufficiently so that we can package it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it might be looked at 2 weeks from now, and since we also talked about backlog, you also know that it might not get looked at for another year. And so we need to think long-term about how we package our evidence. And, Donna, you also mentioned cross-contamination, and that's also a very important consideration, and that's where training becomes essential. And so one of the things what we're always trying to do at a scene or as part of an investigation is we're trying to establish linkages. We try to link our suspect to our victim. We try to link our suspect to our crime scene. Sometimes we have to link our victim to our crime scene. And so we do that a lot with what we call trace evidence, right? If we had, if you were in a room that had carpet in it, perhaps one of the carpet fibers from that room is now attached to your shoe, and you've taken it from the room and you've now put it in the on the floor in your car. And so I can draw an inference that you might have been in this room because that carpet fiber is now in the front of your car.
Mm-hmm.
But I lose the ability to make that connection if I inadvertently reintroduce the items that are separated in the evidence bag. And so if I inadvertently take the carpet fiber that's on the floor of your car, which I'm using to make the draw the conclusion that you were in a particular room, and I put it together with evidence that was from the room already, now I can't say anything about it. And so I always have to think about how am I making a connection. And I never want to introduce two items that are separated because I lose the ability to say that they were once connected because they were present in the same crime scene. Because now it means that, well, they could be connected because you reintroduced them.
And is it because of a chemical reaction when you talk about the cross-contamination?
Not necessarily. It might simply be because we physically put the evidence back together.
Okay.
And so we don't want to do that because we lose the ability to say that the evidence was ever together to begin with. I'll give you another example to make it even clearer. Let's say somebody goes and reports that they were assaulted by somebody that they don't know. And they saw the car that the person left in and they give a license plate to the police. And so 20 minutes later, the police notice this car driving down the road. It's the right license plate. They pull the car over. And they begin talking to the occupant of that car. And they say, you know, we have somebody at our police department that says you assaulted them. They say, do you know so-and-so? And the person in the car says, nope, I've never met them.
Mm-hmm.
And as the investigation continues, we seize clothing from the victim and from the suspect. Now, if the suspect is not telling the truth, and they actually did meet once before because the suspect did assault the victim, we might find something connecting the suspect to the victim, whether it's their blood on the victim's clothing, whether it's fibers from the suspect's clothing on the victim's clothing. There's something that we would look for that connects the victim and the suspect together.
Okay.
And if we inadvertently reintroduce those two things together, we don't know whether or not it's because we did it or because it actually happened as part of the crime being committed.
Right. If it's by chance or it is really part of the evidentiary chain, is that right?
Exactly. Is it because we did it or is it because it really happened?
Right. So you have to have lots and lots of supplies there, lots of bags and everything for everything to be placed singularly, individually at a scene then?
Yes, and
yes.
We also need to be sure that we are constantly changing our gloves.
Mm-hmm.
And so particularly when we consider how sensitive the instruments are now when it comes to amplifying DNA, we only need a few cells worth of DNA in order to get a useful profile. So if I, without realizing it, use the same gloves and hold an item of evidence for my suspect and then touch an item of evidence for my victim, that might be all we needed to have happen in order to introduce the suspect's DNA to the victim's evidence, and that would confuse us.
Right.
That would be a very egregious example of cross-contamination.
And also, isn't it sort of in the back of your mind that you don't want to give any, shall we say, ammunition to defense attorneys to raise doubt and say that might have been, you know, from another source or contaminated, et cetera?
Sure. One of the things that I would want to testify to if I was asked as part of this particular case but well, what are your standard procedures? What is your protocol? And I would talk about how I always change my gloves. I touch an item of evidence, I immediately change my gloves so that I never run into the situation of cross-contamination. And it goes beyond simply changing your gloves, but if you're not even aware of the possibility, you certainly can't take steps to try to limit the potential of it occurring.
Yes. Well, I think the more you do it, like you say, you practice, and it just becomes part of your routine and what you do and becomes part of, you know, part of the whole scheme. So I got that appreciation from attending your class, and, you know, it stuck with me, which is good. We just have about 4.5 minutes here. I have a couple other little things, and I wondered whether, as an instructor, as a professor at HOI, and what are your goals? What is it that you want to have students come away with, in particular, in this day and age with all the challenges that you have? Is there anything that you can tell us off the top of your head with regard to that? You know, there's students coming through. You know, everyone wants to attend Henry Lee, as far as I know. And here you have the, you know, maybe the cream of the crop or whatever. What do you want them to come away with from your classes?
Well, I do think we have the cream of the crop. I am thoroughly impressed with how intelligent and how eager the students are in the forensic science program. And I have the privilege of being, perhaps for many of them, their first exposure to forensic science and in a classroom setting, aside from perhaps an experiment or two. So I take it's an awesome responsibility to try to introduce them to forensic science in a responsible way. And what I try to do, I think my benefit or what I bring to that, and is my perspective. I am educated as a forensic scientist, but I chose to spend my time investigating crime scenes where, you know, believe it or not, not a lot of forensic science is used. We don't do a lot of testing out at a crime scene. We try to do that under more controlled circumstances. And I try to show them how, you know, the world as they've seen it up to this point, whether it's through television, whether it's through news, whether it's through books, is not really how we do the job. And so I show them what they think they understand, and then I show them how it might really work. And I constantly go back and forth. I share the science, and then I show the application. And I'd like to think that when my students leave my class at the end of the semester, they have a much better appreciation for how forensic science is really used in a criminal investigation. And if I've done that, then I think I've been successful.
Well, it sounds like a very good goal. And I think that I got that sense from attending, and, you know, you always had some very good anecdotes to offer with regard to, you know, to prove your point, which I think is very helpful as well. But I wondered if we have about a minute and a half. You know, you talked about using a tackle box, perhaps, in creating more evidence boxes, if you will, if you need more testing materials, if you're going to a lot of crime scenes. And I wondered if you could tell us, is there one particular piece of equipment that might be multi-useful if you're going from one crime scene to another? Is there one tool?
Sure. There is one tool that I would say I brought to every crime scene, and perhaps you'll be disappointed to know it didn't go in a tackle box. It was my thought process. It was my way of thinking. It was my thought process.
Oh, your thought process.
As a scientist, I was taught to use the scientific method to work my way through a problem.
Okay.
And using the scientific method requires an adherence to a process. So instead of simply trying to prove yourself right, which is what most of us do in life, isn't it?
Yep.
We try to prove ourselves wrong. So if we come up with an idea as to what we think happened to the crime scene, rather than simply picking the items of evidence that support what we believe, we try to find evidence to undermine what we believe. And only when we can't do that, if we're not successful in doing that, do we have something to work with. And so as
very
uninteresting as that might sound, that is what I brought to every scene, and that's what
well,
I teach my students.
That's great. We're just at the end, Pete, and I'm going to have to ask you, I wonder if maybe in the winter you can come back with one of your colleagues and we can do some other topics. I would love to do that. If you're amenable, maybe we could talk about that. But in the meantime, I'm going to have to sign off. Thank you, Kim Colton.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Pete, let's keep in touch, please. And remember, when it helps to helping survivors of crime, don't just try. Make it happen. Please tune in next Saturday to Shattered Lives, and we'll see you again. Good night.
Good night. Thank you, Peter.
Good
thank
night.
You
thank you,
me.
Peter. I'll be in touch with you soon, okay? All right.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Thank you, Donna.
Yep. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.